This is Akafe. Laura Marie and Jessica Marie proudly present A Court of Fandoms and Exploration, a podcast. Fair warning, everything the hosts say is explicit, full of spoilers and adult content, and shall not be used against them. They have opinions. Let's try not to drag anyone for expressing themselves and just have fun for an hour. We all deserve it.
This episode contains spoilers from Pretty Boys Are Poisonous with mentions of ACOTAR, The Vagina Monologues, and Transformers. The full list, please see show notes. There are also discussions surrounding sexual assault, miscarriages, and toxic relationships.
Everybody, and welcome to A Court of Fandoms and Exploration, your weekly deep dive into the fantasy literature and fandoms that we love. I'm Laura Marie.
And I'm Jessica Marie.
And today we are welcoming a new addition to our ACOFE lineup. This is episode one of Pop Culture Poetry.
And we're kicking it off with Pretty Boys Are Poisonous, a collection of poems by Megan Fox. And we're kind of adding this new collection in the same way that we have like our bonus episodes, our special episodes with new guests. We wanted to continue the conversation of fandoms and exploration by discussing poetry in pop culture.
Well, let's discuss poetry. Jess, do you have a history with poetry? Do you like poetry? Tell me about poetry.
I feel like my history with poetry is kind of the same as everybody else's. Like, I learned it in high school just because of the poetry section. And it felt difficult for me then. It feels difficult now, except that, I don't know, I feel like poetry maybe has shifted a little bit in regards to like social media in general, and it feels more palatable. That being said, the poetry that I've seen on socials doesn't seem to always mirror what I, the very bare bones that I remember from our formative educations. And like, you know, poems used to rhyme, the format of a haiku, iambic pentameter. But again, couldn't teach it for the life of me. What about you?
Honestly, the exact same as you. Like that elementary school poetry unit, it hits hard. And it is, you know, you're sitting there in a classroom of like 20 some other kids in silence with that lined paper in front of you being like, write a poem. And you're like, what?
Everybody just knows roses are red, violets are blue, rhyme something.
And fuck you.
Right.
And it's just like, well, okay. I in particular, one of my very formative memories is sitting in that silent classroom and a lot of boys going up to our teacher just being like, what the fuck? Like, what do I do? Like, I don't, what is this? And it was a struggle to be creative. Because I know I was struggling, but I was sitting there in silence. I was not getting up to go to the teacher and be like, help me, please. But it was a line of boys who had trouble with this. And that was an interesting observation that is not mirrored in kind of the research that I found when I was looking a little bit later on. But yeah, I think... And I want to know your opinion on this too, Jess. So we always had like the Shakespeare unit. You said the pentameter. We got to rhyme this shit, right? I vividly remember the Shakespeare units in school and the reading out loud and trying to find the rhythm, right? Because Shakespeare sounds best when you get that rhythm and you have that like feeling because you actually like understand what's being said, right? But that goes to media literacy and just like literacy in general and like where we're lacking in that. What I want your opinion on though, Jess, is I vividly remember the Vagina Monologues.
Oh, I love the Vagina Monologues.
I do.
Oh my God. We had like what was like the point system that the cultural credits that we had in undergrad? And there was, it was a great performance. If I could find another one, I would see it again, 100%. But continue with what you were going to say. I'm sorry.
Well, no. So the vagina monologues were this. So, you know, the poetry unit, obviously, the school poetry unit. But the vagina monologues was really this first time that I was exposed to a contemporary, shocking at the time, subject matter on stage, like with everybody there
being performative.
Yeah, being very performative. And then you feeling emotion, being like, yes, yes, like these are my feelings that you're like relating on stage. This, like,
you unlocked something. I completely forgot about this. This is so good.
Right. And this feeling, and in that particular setting, it was like a bunch of women, it was, or queer space, and everyone was very like in, it was very safe, right? We were all there sharing these very intimate monologues, which could be considered poetry in the same way that, you know, I would say, maybe bold, a lot of Instagram, I'm going to say Instagram poets are poetry, right? If we're using a broad definition of poetry, the vagina monologues absolutely stand out to me. I love that I unlocked this for you.
I completely, and I remember going for cultural credit. And it was the first time that, again, poetry in a way felt palatable and understood, because I think in our high school, middle school, you know, elementary school formative education, sometimes, especially when there was such a focus on Shakespeare, you can feel it could make you feel dumb that you don't understand or you don't grasp it. So you're like, well, poetry is not going to be for me. I just got to muster through this to get the grade that I need to grade, and then on to the next. Then I never have to think about sonnets again.
And, you know, that's interesting, too, because you're saying that, and I immediately thought of, like, the rise of, like, slam poetry, right? And, like, and rap music, obviously, to me, is poetry. I could never in a million years ever put together words like that. It is incredible, that the skill that that takes.
There is, like, a lyricism that comes with poetry, absolutely, especially in, like, the hip-hop community.
Well, and also you want to just like pivot a little from that, the Tortured Poet Society.
Yes, I'm so excited.
we're recording this in March 2024. So just for context, we know it's coming. So the conversations around that, Jess, I don't know how you feel, but my For You page has been like, oh, you just know he called her that. You just know he like patted her on the head and was like, how's my tortured little poet? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. The condescension. You can just feel. You can feel it. Feel it in the silence, Swifties. Absolutely.
There you go. So I think that kind of framing of like, how's my tortured little poet is a good way to kind of jump to this article that I want to talk about. All right. So I read this article called Gender Disparity in Poetry Publishing. It's More About the Numbers by Angela France. And this was published March 10th, 2024. You know, I love good dates.
Recently.
Or no, I'm sorry. 2014.
Oh, okay. But still, obviously, it's going to be applicable. Otherwise, you wouldn't be bringing it up. And we'll have the link in the show notes.
Yes. This article is just talking about how poets, especially women, tend to shy away from using I in their work, and that there is not a barrier when it comes to men using I. And it starts off with saying like women have an internalized fear of being and saying things about themselves, which I find very interesting. Of course, all of this is to frame our conversation about Pretty Boys Are Poisonous by Megan Fox.
Well, that goes with the conversation that I feel like that is always intertwined with the podcast and our episodes of just women and femininity in general, and not having to, you know, we're in a society that we were raised to be humbled and not take for what we've earned and what we deserve. And if we do, we have certain labels slapped onto us.
Absolutely. And I'm just going to pull just a few quotes from this before we jump into our conversation. So this article is talking about critical reception of women's poetry, specifically confessional poetry, has come to mean that to label a woman's poem as autobiographical or to identify autobiographical sources or voices is tantamount to denying its creative or aesthetic value. This sort of prejudice against domestic confessional or autobiographical poetry does not seem to apply to male poets.
Of course it doesn't.
Specifically, they're talking about this collection of poetry called Rain, includes intimate poems about this male author's children. And the reviews called the collection a poignant and remarkable book.
Which is funny because this also ties, like, I just think we recently had the conversation in our female friendships episode, is the hypocrisy of it all.
Yes.
Why is it okay for one but not the other?
Yes. The critical reception of any woman's poetry that can be labeled confessional has engendered a self-consciousness about the I, which contributes to women being uncomfortable writing that way. Specifically, while birthing and parenting surely belong with the great poetic themes such as love and death, it seems women can only be accepted as narrators when it is going awry. They can write about miscarriage or death. They can write about failing and being inadequate and preferably also being suicidal. But a straightforward poetic exploration of the miracle of creating a human being is regarded as something akin to grabbing a stranger's arms, fixing them with a glittering eye, and forcing them to look at family photos. My God.
God forbid women write about strong, positive experiences. We need to be the tortured little poets.
Mm-hmm. It is just absolutely...
Or it's only acceptable, is what it's saying, when we are tortured and sad and weak and broken.
Yes, yes. And then to add to this, just to add to this, there is a little bit of numbers. You know, I love these numbers. There's a quote. I went through a pile of over 70 reviews collected over a two-year period up to 2003 and up to last weekend. So that was 2014. And even I found the statistics shocking. I counted full-length reviews of 66 other new poetry books, but only 10 of those were by women writers. Those 66 books were reviewed by 38 different critics. Only 4 of those were women. So, there is a snapshot into the kind of, I don't know, environment of poetry, right? Women are discouraged from writing about their life experiences, childbirth, miscarriage, death, all of these feelings that they have, these emotional complex feelings, children.
We're just emotional creatures. We must be on our period.
Yeah. And men have no problem writing about these things. And then in the same vein, men are writing more books and more reviewers are men. And then women.
In a lot of spaces, not just in like in a lot of space, like media spaces and everything.
But but to frame it in this context of poetry, the reviews for Megan's book are wildly ranging from both spectrums. I think there are people that love it, and then there are men that are horrific in the reviews for this. And those voices, unfortunately, are kind of drowning out the positive voices here because they are just so like vitriolic. So circling into our conversation of this book, Jess, I have told you several times, I think, but especially during your audio book journey, that I do not like autobiographical books. I don't like this. You know, I don't like it when celebrities write books about themselves. I don't like to know a celebrity that way.
Yeah, for me, that was how I got. I mean, we know this if you've followed our first kickoff introductory episode. that's how I got into audiobooks, was hearing stories, specifically Elvis Duran's memoir, because I grew up listening to him on the radio. So I was like, oh, this is just going to be like a long radio segment. And it was a great way to train my ear and my mind to get into audiobooks. But to that, something we also always say on the podcast is always meet your idols.
Yes, always meet your idols. So then you're looking at me like, Laura Marie, how then can you can you hate this, like, this like, what is it? First person source? Like this like primary yeah. source. How can you hate this primary source of this person's life when you want to know your idols? Well, here's the thing. When you, and Jess, you know this as well, I'm not saying anything new to you. Mm-hmm. When you meet your idols, it's like a flash in the pan. It is most of the time, very fast. You're catching a vibe very quickly. You're having one interaction and you can like gauge how they are. Honestly, like, good people are good people. It doesn't matter what's going on. You can tell that. But there is still like a bit of distance. You can still maintain the like mystique a little bit about that. And then when you have a biography, you're just like slapped in the face with these celebrities' most intimate moments. I'm thinking of honestly, Matthew Perry's book.
Oh.
And then how that wrapped up. And it's just like, damn it. I don't want to know any of this. I want to keep you how I had you in my head, especially now, R.I.P. Matthew Perry, you know, but it's strange and it does kind of color your opinion of that person. So why do I like celebrity poetry? Because I do like celebrity, because I celebrity said poetry.
So. But this isn't your first exposure to celebrity poetry, right?
No. Okay. I had an ex-boyfriend in high school give me the lead singer of Smashing Pumpkins. His name is Billy. His last name starts with a C. His book. And I was like, oh, this is who you think I am. All right. I guess I'm cool. I was very like, huh. And then my first celebrity poetry book that I bought with my own money was Jewel's book, A Night Without Armor. And I remember very specifically, she was on MTV and she was doing an interview with Kurt Loder, and he corrected a typo in her book live on air. And she just like sat back and looked at him, and I think she called him an asshole. And it was just like, whoa, what is this? And
it seems like such a, like a core memory, especially associating it with poetry.
Yeah. And then so I saw that interview, and then I immediately went out and got the book. What
oh,
the fuck
that's
are they
why
talking
you,
about?
Okay.
Yeah. I was like, what are they talking about? Because she was so just like, ugh. And I'm sure you could Google that interview. It's famous. She's talked about it before. She was just like mortified. This type of this published, it was a whole like, oh my God. So that was my first exposure. And so it was kind of like, and I was young there, not in Jewel, you know, she was popular. It was just like, huh. And so being that age and reading that book, it was like, well, poetry is kind of difficult. She's a celebrity songwriter. I kind of know her. She lives in Alaska, and I saw her reaction. Do I relate to this? I mean, no, not really. It's kind of like a song or a story. It's not her. It doesn't feel like her real life. There is a little bit of separation there. So then cue this book, Pretty Boys Are Poisonous. I read this traditionally. I did not read this through audio because, again, I really wanted to maintain that distance, because it is pretty clear who these are about.
Oh, you mean the 6'4" damsel in distress is not specific enough?
The rock star. Yeah.
Snow White and the rock star.
Woo. Yeah. Very clear who these are about. So, and I guess maybe this is a me thing, because I'm not in a toxic relationship with Machine Gun Kelly, and I don't want to feel bad for Megan Fox. I don't want that. So I read this traditionally in a, like, okay, let's put on my blinders. Let's just read poetry for poetry. Let's see what I can get out of this. And that was difficult because the layers of Machine Gun Kelly are intense. But also, I do think that speaks to the public eye and social media and the overexposure that they had, you know, a few years ago. And that back when I was growing up and, like, Jewel's book came out and, like, Billy's book came out, this shit wasn't so prominent. So that overexposure wasn't there.
Yeah, celebrity culture was just so different in the 90s. I mean, if they talk about it just like in a media landscape in general, I mean, when you're promoting movies or promoting projects or people are following around like celebrity gossip, you either kind of believed the tabloids or you didn't, because that was your only source of, quote unquote, the saturation, which wasn't saturation. You got it once a week and then you read that for the whole week till the next weekly came out. So, and now it's everywhere, you know, in the news, in the tabloids, on your socials, in every aspect, whether it's an image or a reel or everything in between.
Yep. Yep. Oh, okay. So I do want to touch on the review and criticism and kind of evolution of modern poetry a little bit. I know that sounds like really lofty. It's not at the end of this. but let's talk about Pretty Boys Are Poisonous. Jess, you gifted me this book.
I did. It's signed. I got a notification. I was on the plane and I landed and I bought 3 copies for Laura, myself, and my sister-in-law. And because that's her, like, favorite celebrity girly pop. And we just, I mean, if you've been following the podcast, you know we love Megan. We did an episode on Jennifer's Body. I've had personal interactions with Megan Fox. I only can say the most positive things about my experiences. So I'm always here to support her. And it was really interesting to read these poems because she is giving a peek behind the curtain. We know who some of these poems are about. But like Laura, I also read this traditionally. And before even reading it, it was one of the questions that I was kind of going back and forth with last week. And I was like, you know what? I know we have the traditional copy, but I don't know if I'm going to read the audio, because typically I read all of my celebrity memoir and biography books through the audio. And I took it as, if I don't read it with her as the audio, am I reading it wrong by having my own interpretations? At which point, Laura, you said to me that she's like, poetry is supposed to be interpreted and subjective to the reader. It is a form of art. And that was, it helped me have my own experience with the poems as opposed to looking at the poems through her lens.
Because that, I mean, again, I'll touch it on the end, but looking through this book through her lens, a huge criticism of this was like, well, this is just her cry for help. Like, this is her cry for help. Why isn't anybody doing anything?
But to that, I feel like it's, even if it's glaringly there, if you are in a toxic relationship, there's only so much somebody can do. You also have to want to get yourself out. And I feel like it's always easier said than done when you are on the outside looking in.
Yeah, exactly. And she does address that in a very beautiful poem that I will talk about a little bit later. So, Jess, we both read this. The structure and format of the book, I think, is very interesting. We should touch on. The audiobook is 38 minutes, if you're interested. She narrates it. The hardback is like
50-something pages.
155, 156, if you include that last page of art. And some poems are two pages. Some are two lines on an entire page. This one is three. So it's a lot of
Look at length. You tabbing your books.
Yeah, I'm tabbing my books. So just for like reference, there's a lot of blank space sometimes, which I wonder if that was like a conscious choice when planning out the way that this book looks, because the art is very specific. Some poems are two pages. Some are spaced very intentionally.
And not every poem gets art. So even if there's in the physical copy, so even like you were saying, like you have some pieces that have art on one side and then some like have art on one side and a poem on the other. And then some pages where it's just the poem and there's no art on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Stylistically, I'm like looking through this now and it was interesting that you picked that up.
Yeah, just lots of empty space on some of these. And I do wonder, too, if that is meant to like invoke a certain emotion. My thoughts going into this is that she was very intentional doing this. So then I should be intentional when looking at it.
Well, she's an her son. She's a Taurus sun. She's an earth sign sun. So I feel like anything with planning, this was intentional.
Yep. So I just want to give, you know, credit where credit is due and take the time to look. So, you know, that's part of it. And obviously we reread this and we have favorite poems. Jess, I'm just curious. I want to know your thoughts, your favorites, where you went with this.
Okay, so I'm going to open page 9, which is Eros. And I'm just going to read it real quick because they're all really short. And I say page 9 is going to be my starter because it was the first one that I had an audible reaction to that I gasped. But again, and I'll get into it, where I'll just read it. This one is from page 9. It's called Eros. And she says, "My protector, my abuser, my captor, my friend, my love, the creature that seeks me out when he is thirsty for tears." Now, that was like, I stopped because even though we know that the book is titled Pretty Boys Are Poisonous, and we know a lot of these stories are about, even though she has interviews saying that, you know, some of it's going to be, you know, assumption. I looked at that as a relationship with a toxic father figure, being that's the person who's supposed to protect you, who also winds up abusing, like breaking everything down. And so often that, like, if you have a father in your life or a father figure, you're usually taught like that's how you receive that love, is going to be how that might manifest in the future. How you receive it later in the future. And I feel like it's an interesting way, the way I thought of it, that it's at the beginning of the book with that in mind of, again, how I took that as the reader reading this art.
Well, and you say that it's in the beginning of the book. There's a really good observation there. I tabbed, as you said, I tabbed my book. I used two colors. I used red and black. And most of my black tabs are kind of in the middle of the book, and
were your color tabs intentional?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. And the black tabs are kind of her, Megan's stepping into her female power type poems, which I thought were very powerful because they're like, you know, the juxtaposition of these very vulnerable poems as well.
You see, and I feel like you see the progression because even her last two poems, I mean, she's confirmed them are about her miscarriages. So it's like beginning into like this new cycle also.
And going back to the article that I mentioned in the beginning of the episode, that's something women miscarriage. It's something that we should be able to write about, but is not something that people really love because it's a male dominated space. But men can write about it and it's fine. Don't we just love that? Don't we just love that? Jess, did you have another? I just am so interested in your thoughts.
I want to do like back and forth maybe because I don't want to be. I would like to hear your first one that you want to bring up.
Oh, sure. All right. So the first one that I want to bring up is I Would Die For You, Oh, JK, LOL.
What page is that?
This is page 15.
Okay.
They're very short. I am dramatic, so I'm going to read these.
Please.
And again, I love reading out loud in front of people. It's something that I'm very comfortable with. I can do it upside down, backwards. I just love it. So it is another reason why I very intentionally chose to not have Megan as the narrator here so that I could read these with my own rhythms and emphasis on all of these things. So here we go. If Romeo and Juliet had lived long enough, maybe they too would have gotten to the point where Romeo was so numb to her that he would have read Twitter in bed than fuck. Because there's always tomorrow for that. Or maybe the next day. Or the next. I don't know. He's just so busy now. I still imagine she kills herself in the end, though. Only he doesn't follow. He just signs up for Raya instead. I love this. I love this because it demonstrates a few things that I really like about poetry. And it's this mixing of this classical feeling. We have this imagery of Romeo and Juliet. We have the modern imagery. We have this very intimate problem of this famous couple just getting numb to each other. But you have a sentence that is difficult to read out loud because of the way that it is structured. It's the second line. Would have gotten to the point where Romeo was so numb too. And the second line goes, her. And of course that's intentional, but it is difficult to find a rhythm and pattern there. So again, poetry is not an easy thing, I think, for anybody. But it, again, it's not easy to read, even when it is something that you enjoy.
What do you think makes a good poet or poem? I guess we know poem, but like what would... I guess it's one and the same, the question.
You know, okay, me statements, a rhythm. Okay. It doesn't matter what it is. When you can get into a rhythm of something and then the words, the effort goes away and there's a flow there and you can just hit it. When someone is excellent at Shakespeare and they get into that rhythm and you're just fascinated. I feel like that is something that is a skill.
I feel like that's how we saw the performances in Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. Like, I didn't feel it made consuming traditional Shakespeare in a modern setting so palatable and easy to consume. Understood what was going on. But if you had read traditional Shakespeare in high school, you're like, what the fuck is going on?
Yes. Yes. And again, people really didn't like that modern retelling of Romeo and Juliet because they thought that it took away from the original source material when, in fact, all it did was bring a wider audience to something that was labeled as difficult in school. Right? Like, come on.
I feel like it made all of Baz Luhrmann's projects get a lot of lashback. But it did bring a whole different audience to love and enjoy it and appreciate Shakespeare the way it's intended.
Yes. Yes. I would like to talk about coercive persuasion. This is page 53 in the hardcover. Mm-hmm. This is my first black tab. This is the first one where I was like, oh, okay. All right. Okay. I can see where it's going. Right. Okay. Like I can see because again, going back to the way that the tabs are placed, just my own observations, this does kind of read like a story, like a toxic love story where towards the last part of the middle and the end, you know, there's a little bit of strength there. But then there is this devastation of a miscarriage. So it's like this up and down and up and down and then up me and then down. I really find it interesting. Okay, so page 53, coercive persuasion. The circus that is your life lawlessly spins around you, and each of us has a role to play, giving our most convincing performances as wonderstruck plebeians in awe of your talent and power. It has now become time for me to deliver my lines. It's meant to reassure you of your unique and incomparable gifts, just like all the others who have gone before me today. But your tequila-drenched insults have caused the compliments in my mouth to turn to broken glass, and I am so tired of the taste of my own blood that I swallow my words and fantasize about killing you instead, while you anxiously demand to know why I'm smiling. And you can see it, right? Like that, those words create a very visual kind of environment for you where, like, you can see her just like standing there as someone is just it is a relatable situation, and you do not have to know her or him or their background or what's going on. You can read the words on the page and know exactly the feeling.
That's what I feel like this collection is, that you can take them out of it and feel like it's applicable to different aspects of your life.
Absolutely.
Because if we're talking about her leaning in to and reclaiming her feminine power, we can jump to page 69. I am Prince Charming. And she writes, "They say that when the wind blows, the spirits are talking. So I stood outside in a storm today, soaking wet and battered. I let them speak. They told me that I believe you are my hero, whose integrity and kindness are just temporarily shrouded by the pain of your past. And that most certainly it's my soul's purpose to save you so that we can finally live happily ever after. But truthfully, the wind whispered, you have been my story's most insidious villain. And this is my final battle, my resurrection phase. It's time to defeat you by rescuing myself."
Isn't that so good?
You know, we love when you can rescue yourself. And I feel like that's so much of what you tried for the longest time for me to see in myself. And you finally got me to see that with exposing me to ACOTAR years ago, which is so wild to think that was 2020. And here we are discussing still all these years later about that empowerment that it takes for you to find within yourself and not just always saving others.
That is the perfect jump to page 87. You wanted Marilyn Monroe, but you got Joan of Arc instead.
Yes, I have that one too. We talk about it.
Right? I've humbled kings alone. I've fought wars against titans. Still, they foam at the mouth, attempting to silence me, because I am a mirror that reminds them of what they cannot have. You mistook me for a possession when I was a nuclear weapon all along. Bam! Print that out, like, put it up, right? Inspirational quote that shit, put it in a classroom. Like, that is good shit. That is good shit. I don't need to know who anybody is. This spoke to me in a way that other classical poetry just, like, didn't hit, right? Like, I'm sorry, you know, the paths are diverging in the forest. All right, Robert. But this made me feel the emotion.
Which isn't that the intent of poetry? One of its many intents is to evoke emotion out of it. I mean, yes, all writing, but good poetry should make you feel something.
Good poetry should make you feel something. Jess, do you have another one in here that made you feel something?
Let me go. Oh, if we jump to, I picked my top favorite three because I just didn't know how much time we were going to have. This is like my third top one in no particular order, was page 97, your optical illusion. "The further away from you I get, the more I realize I was never small. It was just a matter of forced perspective." And again, I loved this one because I think to what you were saying earlier, as a reader, you can relate to this, but you could relate to it so much bigger, and just and not just in a romantic sense, in regards to relationship with friends, relationship with family, relationship to your career or to your work environment. I feel like it was just so much bigger when you just feel stuck or lost, or you're like confused of what's going on in your life. And that was like, it says your optical illusion of, and finding a different perspective. And I thought it was just so much deeper than, I mean, I guess that is poetry. It's so much deeper than, you know, the 12 words that are on the page.
And I do think that speaks to media literacy and the willingness to be uncomfortable and to learn and to sit with your emotions and to really think about, to be introspective. And that is difficult for a lot of people. You know, it is kind of, in its way, its own form of meditation, which is incredibly difficult for some people. So I love that we are able to have these conversations. This is just so fun.
I know. We've never done that, like, ever in our friendship. This is really fun that we're doing this.
I have 5 left that I... Wait, where are my tabs? There. I have 5 left that I cannot choose. Like, I cannot narrow these down. So I would say these 5 are, like, my top 5. Okay. But I don't just want to, like, blow through all 5. So I'll do 2.
I have a couple that I can still bring up and we can still discuss. I'm sure they might even be ones that you have tabbed. Just let me know the page numbers because I want to keep along.
This is page 93. Hell hath no fury. I love this. Not all goddesses fly. Some of us struggle on the ground as the mortal men we gave our hearts to keep their feet on our necks. But one day we will remember our own voices and turn them all to ashes. I read this and my immediate thought was all day, every day, right?
I was playing that song on loop before we started recording. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You make me do too much labor. That's all I could think of when I was reading this, because it really invokes the feeling of, like, we're all goddesses. That song makes me feel that we are all goddesses. And this, it's like, not all goddesses fly. Some of us struggle on the ground. Immediately relatable. Immediately. It is acknowledging our power, but also acknowledging we're not all the same. And some of us chose this path. We got here. It's different. But we will remember, we'll get back to that, and we'll turn them all to ash. We love it. You know, Aylin, Burnham, like, let's go.
It's very intersectional, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just really, really was moved by that. That was okay. So I use black and red tabs. Black is, like, women's power. Red is, like, vulnerability and, like, heart stuff. My last red tab is page 109. 3 lines, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 words. Yeah.
Page 109. I remember I was like, ooh, when I read this one.
This poem called Unrealized Potential is something, I mean, these, like, 13 words are something that I think is one of the most relatable poems that are in this book that anyone can read and feel a little, like, twinge in your heart, because I think everyone has had an experience like this, and it doesn't have to be, like, this poem is about love, but I think the tragedy of unrealized potential is something that really eats at you, right? It is really hard to digest. So page 109, unrealized potential. I will always be in love with the man that you'll never become. Like, God damn, how many people stay in relationships trying to get him? I'm using the gender that she's using, trying to get him to be the man that you saw when you fell in love with him, right? Like, you see that potential. This is, I think, also Vanessa Hudgens and Austin Butler, right? Like, she saw all that potential for years and years and years when he was just, like, in the trenches, right?
But, and that's one of the things they talk about, like, are you falling in love with the person as is, or are you falling in love with the potential of the person? And that's what unrealized potential is. Like, I felt you wanted to change this person who wasn't going to change or isn't going to change. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you kind of have to make those decisions of, is this something that I want to tolerate and be okay with it?
Yep. Yep. Those are my two. I have two left. Jess, give me.
I think a good follow-up to that would be, I'll say page 115, a 6'4" damsel in distress, because it follows up with unrealized potential of, you're always waiting to be rescued and never willing to do the rescuing. And this is being directed towards the person who has that unrealized potential and never wanting to help themselves. And I think that it can also be, again, some of these poems, and again, and I also think one thing I do want to say is, you could read these poems and this collection at different points of your life, just like with reading in general and what we discuss on the podcast, and have different takeaways, and it'll apply to you differently. Or maybe some are going to become more relatable when they weren't before. And it's another way of people in your life, again, people in general, no matter the relationship, of you getting exhausted for always being the one to rescue that person. You're like, at what point are you going to pick yourself up? At what point do you want to help yourself? I can only do so much. And it's always me.
Yeah. And you know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Like, at what point is enough enough, right? Damn, that was good. You're good. That was a good one.
You have a couple more tabs, right?
I have two. I have two left that I've narrowed it down to. This one is my favorite. My favorite one in the book is page 131. This is called Prove It, Orpheus. I love this one. All right. When they ask you, who is your greatest love? Don't whisper my name. Scream it. When they ask you, what was your biggest regret? Don't write it in a song. Cut yourself open and write it in blood. I love this. I have boys from my past that still bother me. I say bother me. I have boys from my past that still message me with declarations, and they didn't when it counted, and they're doing it now. And it's just like, all right. Obviously I made an impression. Obviously it was more impactful for you than it was for me. If you're still like, you know, so like, you know, what is your biggest regret? Scream it. Tell me, like, all of these things. I love this.
Have they yet to do that, or it's just still declarations and not telling you more?
Good question. It's about half.
I really fucked up.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize it.
Of course. We know. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. But specifically for this poem, I love this. It's like this. It's passion, but it's also strength and this like unwaverable. Like no. When they ask you, do this. Do this.
Well, this
And again, the vulnerability of like, write it in blood, like the intimacy there, right? Again, taking away who these people are and taking the words on the page, the intimacy there, like, cut yourself open and write it with your lifeblood, like, say it. I like this.
Well, and I think it also aligns with something that's consistent that you've said on our just like, in episodes in general, is show, not tell. And this is in the very literal sense of the words. Okay, do it. Show me.
Do it. All right. This is my last one. Photosynthesis, page 149. I read this, and the only thing in my head was Destiny's Child, Survivor.
Okay.
That is the only thing that was in my head when I was reading this. All right. Photosynthesis. You thought that if you stopped watering me, I would die. But you forgot to dig up my roots, and you thought you tried your best, and you weren't able to block me from the light. And while you neglected me, I trusted in the unseen. And now there is a sequoia standing there where that naive sapling used to be. I've outgrown you. And no matter how much you cry or beg, I will never be your giving tree. I fucking love that. That slaps. I work with children and I expose them to the giving tree and to the missing piece very early, probably earlier than a lot of other people. And I start it in the beginning and I read it again and then I read it again and I read it again so that by the end of the year, they understand the message. They understand what's going on, at least, you know, to their best ability. I will not be your giving tree. The story of the giving tree is that little boy comes and he needs everything and that tree gives everything. And at the very end, that tree has given everything and it's a stump and that boy still uses the stump to sit on. And there is a split of people being like, well, that's a very lovely story. And then there's the other side where it's like, that boy is a monster. And I kind of lean that way. That boy is a monster. And I kind of, you know, like, hello, let's look at what he, you know. And so to have that reference here and to know what that is, right? And this also goes to like, you know, literacy and understanding these references and exposure and reading a wide range of things. The giving tree, knowing what that is, and then to have the other imagery of like, you didn't water me, but here I am. I'm stronger. I'm a sequoia. You can't do this. I will not give pieces of myself to you anymore. I mean, talk about stepping into your power, stepping into your strength. I am a survivor, right? I'm not going to give up.
What a great reference. Yeah. For all your, like, between the giving tree and Destiny's Child with Survivor, like those are so poignant to that.
And yeah, and I personally really relate to that. And the book ends with two poems, very sad poems about a miscarriage, which is not something that I can relate to. However, I can relate to the feeling of loss and the feeling of grief and the feeling of emptiness and the floating feeling of having the world ripped out from underneath you. Again, just going to say that words have a very powerful impact. And if you can be objective and read on page, you can find things to relate to. Just like every piece of literature doesn't have to be for you specifically, you can find pieces of yourself if you look hard enough. And people that say that they can't relate to a character just aren't trying enough.
Yeah, there's always going to be a takeaway, regardless of what it is.
Yes.
Which is so interesting because of the reviews and the commentary that came from this book. I mean, I remember talking to you before we started recording that I was just kind of like, perusing YouTube and trying to see what interviews that, you know, of Megan speaking. And there were some book reviewers and the comments were inundated with men and their opinions of Megan's autobiographical, in a sense, collection of poetries. They did not like it at all. And it just, the comments were not passing the vibe check. And you could just tell, like you were saying earlier, the visceral hate that men have towards women, not just her, towards women in general. They love making her their object of their affection. They loved her little poster from Transformers. They loved pleasuring themselves to her. And she reclaims so much power and acknowledges that, and she always has in her interviews. And her poem, it was, let me see, her poem, Seven, The Number of Completion, which I also think is funny for like an ode to Friends, because there's an episode about that with Monica and Seven. She just says, I hate men, seven times in seven lines. And I feel like that's so relatable. It's like when you have the conversation, not all men, but there's enough of them that you have to say that, because the comments were like, she should just be saying, I hate the men that I choose. And you can't dictate somebody's experience. And that's exactly what some of the commentary is.
You're absolutely right. And Megan has said that she has had a very complicated relationship with the men in her life, male directors, that she was like 10 years too early for the Me Too movement. And she got a lot of pushback from that, especially in like around 2008 when she said all that stuff about
Michael Bay.
I remember the media pushback on that. People were like, she should be grateful. Like, he put her on the map. Like, what is she doing? I remember this.
And I will share something here that I don't think it needs to be censored out. But I was on set for a movie that she was working on, and I saw firsthand some of the times that she was late to set because she was interacting with fans. She was having one-on-one time with kids who like remembered her as April in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. She would also take time to say like, look, I can't be out in the streets. It's going to get crazy. Let me take the stuff that you'd like me to sign or personalize while I'm getting touch-ups in my makeup trailer. I'll go ahead and I'll personalize. I'll sign whatever you would like. She was so kind and so humble. And it was just, it's so interesting to hear that that was the conversation happening when I was seeing behind the scenes, like the way she was being painted. And it just, she didn't have enough people on her side who were loud enough that people cared to hear.
Yeah, that people cared to hear. I think that's very important. And then also to kind of pivot just a little bit from this, the actual reviews of the poetry itself kind of are scathing. There are people out here who really dislike this book, and there is a conversation about like what is poetry, which I thought was very interesting. So I am going to be so basic here. Poetry is a literary work in which special intensity is given to the expression of feelings and ideas by the use of distinctive style and rhythm. Okay. So poetry is a genre of literature. All right. So
if you take that definition,
and then listen to these arguments that people are having. Okay. The arguments are modern poetry, which this book would be considered modern poetry. All right, what is it? Modern poetry is not poetry. This is like a general, this is a Reddit thread just talking about like women poets, especially Ruby, and what is going on there. Okay, it's not poetry. At best, it's a compilation of relatable thoughts and thoughtful affirmations. It lacks the most important characteristics that define poetry: rhythm, form, and poetic devices. This is a perfect example of how postmodernism approach to art is destroying art. If anything is considered art, then nothing is art. It loses its value, right? I'm not agreeing with this. I am just reading this. Poetry used to be valued and highly regarded because it wasn't something that anyone could whip out in a few minutes. Just not how everyone could create an oil portrait in an hour. You had to be highly in tune with your emotions and surroundings. Da, 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 da. The truth is that Instagram poets and Instagram poetry has become popular because of people's standards, as well as education in literature and art, have significantly declined. The majority rarely reads anymore outside of the mandatory school curriculum, and I would say also book talk. And when they do, it's rarely poetry. That I would say. It is rarely poetry. So that people do not have a lot of other poetry to compare it to. It talking about Instagram poetry. People, they see a thoughtful sentence broken up into three lines and think it's poetry. Even thoughtful is far-fetched. Again, that is just like a Reddit post, and it's what are some of the reasons that people hate on Rupi and her poetry? What are specific criticisms leveled against her work? Do people generally think her poetry is bad, or are there haters just being overly critical and negative?
I'm curious, and again, I just did not do my research, I guess, for this. I guess I did not. To what you're saying is, and it also ties back to earlier in the episode, is they're saying this to Rupi, which, okay, I'm not negating these criticisms. Are those same criticisms being said towards male poets?
That's the thing. When it comes to modern poetry, yeah, maybe a little bit, because there is this kind of grasp on like the classics are classics and most of the classics are men. Like you have the standout women, right? But like most of the classics are men. And then knowing that the reviewer space is mostly men and that they're pushing mostly, you know, and of course this has changed a bit now, but my God, there are problems in the publishing industry. Whoa. So I just think
the tip of the iceberg of the many issues they have.
Yeah. So I think that the landscape is just very interesting to like take a look at. And then using this modern poetry book by Megan Fox to kind of shine a light on it is fun, I dare say, because I haven't heard anybody talking about this the way that we have been, but we're special and lovely and we like to have these conversations. But also, I think that having a little series of episodes on ACAFE that focuses on poetry is doing its own little exposure. So, you know, we're just
in a way it's a social I don't know if it's a social experiment. It's just a way to, like you said, just talk through different. When was the last time? Maybe I just am not in the right spaces. You see the conversations about poetry.
Yeah. And here's the thing. So pop culture poetry is going to be ongoing. We're going to be covering poetry books by celebrities. If you have, preferably women, just saying
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Just
disclaimer.
Just saying that.
Or anyone. Yeah. Anyone in the queer space.
Yeah. I mean, tell us you don't listen without telling us you don't listen by recommending some dude. But if you have a poet that you think really fits the bill here, that you think a conversation could really be had, kind of in the same vein that we had here, let us know. Because is this an untapped little area? Probably not. Is it new for us? Yeah, and that's exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited to dive into it more because I didn't even realize all of the celebrity poetry books that were out there till this was something that you're like, wait, I'm let me cook, but I have this idea. And we kind of had to flesh it out a little bit. And this is such a fun way to kick it off. But that being said, feel free to follow us on Instagram. We're at ACAFE Podcast. We're also both currently on TikTok, ACAFE Laura and ACAFE Jessica, until the U.S. decides to get rid of it, unless anything happens there. But we look forward to hearing from y'all, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.